Asphalt is a very invasive kind of thing. It's dirty, it's messy. We should consider ourselves lucky today that we aren't out sweeping up ash right now.
Readout erupts, but the ash misses Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 23rd of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state senators express frustration at the governor's handling of the federal stimulus funding.
And I would encourage her to get in touch with both bodies to let us know what her real intention is for the stimulus package.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org.
After months of unrest that kept residents in south-central Alaska on edge, Mount Redoubt is erupting. The volcano has exploded five times since 11 p.m. last night, sending ash as high as 60,000 feet in the air. There are no ashfall advisories at this time, but a few communities received a dusting, and scientists expect the explosions to continue for weeks or months. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Over the weekend, volcanologists started seeing increased earthquake activity on Mount Redoubt. That caught their attention. Then the eruption began. John Power is a geophysicist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He says the explosions of ash have been impressive.
You know, by the time you're moving ash up to 50,000, 60,000 feet, that's a very high plume. Volcanoes typically, that's about as high as they go.
So far, winds have pushed the ash west of Anchorage. Areas around Talkeetna, Cantwell, and Denali Park have received a dusting. A thin layer of heavy residue also fell on the isolated village of Squintna. Steve Childs helps run a lodge there. He says he saw the ash coming down when he peered out his window early this morning.
Oh, it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning. I looked out, and the runway light we have here was just making the entire sky just glow. I knew it wasn't snow. Woke up this morning and let the dog out, and you can see where he walked because it just turned white. Everything else is gray, brownish, and it's very gritty.
There are no roads in and out of Squintna, so he and others in the village are preparing to wait out the eruption. He says he has plenty of food in the freezer and a moose hanging in the shed.
Well, we're very dependent on airplanes and snow machines. That's the only way means to get in and out of here, and there's no way we can drive a snow machine through this. It would just tear it apart. And I doubt if our mail plane or any other airplanes will be flying.
Volcanic ash is different than the wood ash that collects in the bottom of a fireplace. It's rock that the volcano grinds up and then spits out. John Power with AVO says it's invasive and messy.
It's as much of a nuisance as anything else, but it really has a very insidious way of damaging things like mechanical systems, automobiles, computers. You know, it is kind of a problem. It presents a somewhat of a health hazard for people with respiratory problems.
But the primary concern is for aircraft. Alaska Airlines has canceled at least a dozen flights. Power says officials are constantly monitoring the situation to keep passengers safe during the eruption.
Aircraft and ash really don't mix. It's the principal hazard that you see in Alaska. You can imagine flying an airplane into a sandblaster. That's what happens when an airplane encounters an ash cloud. Presently, airplanes are doing all they can to stay out of the ash.
Volcanologists are looking to Redoubt's last eruption in 1989 for clues on how to predict the future. That eruption lasted 5 months. So Power says South Central residents who haven't experienced ashfall shouldn't let down their guard. He says 20 years ago, the volcano exploded off and on for a long stretch.
It varied. There was a time when they were coming about every 3 or 4 days, another time when they were coming every 6 to 7 days. There were some longer periods of repose in there, you know, as much as 2 or 3 weeks. That's what the volcano did last time. In this business, the past is always the key to the future. We might expect the volcano to behave that way again. However, it does have a way of writing a new history, if you will, and the volcano could behave very differently. It could shut down at this point, go into a longer eruption. It's really something where we're going to have to wait and see.
Scientists are hoping to take a helicopter to the volcano to get a close-up view of the eruption and to fix 3 monitoring instruments that have been disabled. Power says the ash clouds can have far-reaching impacts. During the 1989 eruption, ash hampered flights as far away as Texas. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Concerns over readout's continued eruptions extend to an oil collection facility in Cook Inlet at Drift River. Chevron Pipeline Company operates the Cook Inlet Pipeline Company, which runs the Drift River Terminal. John Power with AVO says flooding is a potential problem because the Drift River flows near glacial ice at readout space.
What happens here is when you have a volcanic eruption, you throw a lot of hot material out onto the snowpack. That melts it, causes a large flood of water, what we would call a mud flow. There is evidence that our seismometers suggest that there was some flowage events that occurred last night.
Betty Shore is the Industry Preparedness Program Manager for the state's Department of Environmental Conservation's Spill Prevention and Response Division. Shore says after readout blew 20 years ago, the company built a containment and diversion system.
We've had our own inspectors out at the facility, and apparently it's quite a substantial containment system as well as diversionary dikes that they've constructed in Drift River drainage so that if a mud flow were to come down the riverbed, that it would be diverted from the terminal.
All employees at the terminal have been evacuated, and CIPL says that 2 of 7 tanks are in use, and each has about 74,000 barrels of oil, or more than 6 million gallons, in them. Shore says the state is monitoring the situation.
Our emergency response group is on heightened alert down in Kenai. The Cook Inlet Spill Prevention Group that is the spill responders for the facility also is in heightened alert, and we'll be monitoring it carefully, and if there's any problem, we hope there's no problem with the facility or the pipeline, but we certainly will be responding as quickly as possible if there is anything.
Bob Shavelson with Cook Inlet Keeper says he's concerned with the amount of crude that is still contained at the Drift River Terminal.
Because 6 million gallons is a lot of oil. When we had 5 million gallons on the Seabulk Pride, the oil tanker in 2006 that ran aground in Upper Cook Inlet, we had to bring assets around from Prince William Sound. So we didn't have the capacity to address a 5 million gallon spill if it were to occur in Cook Inlet. And so now we have the potential of 6 million gallons here. I know all the contingency plans and all the paperwork says that we're supposed to be able to do this. I just question in reality whether we can.
A statement from Cook Inlet Pipeline Company says they have notified Cook Inlet oil producers that the Drift River Terminal will not receive, store, or deliver additional crude oil during readout's eruption. Roxanne Sins with Chevron says the company operates 10 of the 14 platforms in Cook Inlet. Sins says Chevron is not shutting down production right now. They're sending crude to the Trading Bay production facility and the Granite Point tank farm. She says they can store crude there for up to 5 days. If readout's activity continues beyond that, they may have to start shutting down platform production. Anticipation of what federal funding will be requested from the federal economic stimulus legislation was at the top of most conversations at the Capitol in Juneau today. A resolution on the Senate floor to request all possible funds from Washington, D.C., even those not approved by Governor Sarah Palin, was postponed because too many members were absent, but the Finance Committee opened hearings on the projects. Management and Budget Director Karen Rehfeld from the start assured members that everything from the federal package is still available.
The governor has not rejected any of the funds that are currently in the federal economic stimulus package.
Although no vote was taken on the acceptance resolution, members of the Senate still debated its merits. Majority Leader Johnny Ellis said the state needs some damage control as a result of the governor's announcement of her stand on the stimulus money last week. Ellis said the message was national, and our congressional delegation must now counter the perception that Alaska doesn't need any federal help.
They're the folks that are now in the position of trying to convince their colleagues in the Congress that Alaska needs money for the Coast Guard, that Alaska needs money for education and training, that Alaska needs money for infrastructure. So we're taking the infrastructure money, but a third of the money was pretty much rejected. Now, I know there's some backtracking and some explanations, and I give people credit for maybe stepping back from some very forward positions that I think were understood quite clearly across the country.
Minority Leader Jean Theriault said the governor's decisions were procedurally no different from any federal income, and she expects legislative committees to follow the same process. Legislators ask the standard questions the governor wants answered. What is the state's obligation if it accepts the money, and do state statutes need to be changed to legally use it?
In addition, if the money is a one-time slug of money, what happens when the money goes away? Will the federal government expect us to come in and backfill with general fund dollars? Or if the federal government doesn't anticipate that or expect it, what do we expect the citizens of Alaska to expect from us when the federal funds go away?
Anchorage Democrat Betty Davis summed up the frustration in dealing with the subject. She would like to see better communication from Governor Palin clarifying her intent.
I feel that a statement needs to come from the governor and not the minority leader to tell us what our intentions are. It would make me feel much better about the situation that we are facing at this point. I wouldn't deny that many of the things that the minority leader stated is not true, but we need to hear it from our governor. And I would encourage her to get in touch with both bodies to let us know what her real intention is for the stimulus package.
The House is scheduled to hear the stimulus resolution and to debate legislative response tomorrow morning. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska scientist helps discover a new prehistoric predator.
If you were living in the seas at those times, this was the animal you would have been on the lookout for more than any other.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Tomorrow, on the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a discussion called Partners in Prevention and Response will take place in Anchorage at the Dena'ina Convention Center. Stan Jones is with the Prince William Sound Citizens Advisory Council. He says the panel will focus on what is still left to do 20 years after the spill to protect Alaska waters from another disaster. Jones says icebergs remain a concern. The Exxon Valdez was attempting to avoid icebergs when it grounded and ripped open on Bly Reef.
So what we did about that is we started a project and paid a good share of the bills to develop a radar system that can actually spot icebergs in the water, which at night or in bad weather is harder than you might think because icebergs, you know, as far as radar is concerned, icebergs are water, so they're hard to distinguish. But what we found is that enough with the right kind of radar and some computer-based signal processing, you can distinguish icebergs from water and produce a usable signal. And so a system to do exactly that was set up on Reef Island, which overlooks Bly Reef, and this system sends its signals back to Valdez, where they're used by the Coast Guard and Alyeska to make shipping-related decisions. So those are probably three of the bigger pieces of the prevention system that have gone in since 1989. In addition, of course, the Coast Guard has better ship-tracking radars now, and they do track the tankers more thoroughly and farther out than they did in 1989.
A lot of emphasis is on prevention, as it should be. But what about response in the event of a spill? What's changed in 20 years in that capacity?
Well, that's also been a big area of focus for us and everybody concerned about oil spill safety in the Sound, including, of course, the government regulators and the oil industry. The biggest change is that there are far more detailed and better contingency plans for preventing and cleaning up oil spills than there once were. And Alyeska Pipeline, which would have to start any response, has far, far more equipment to do so than it did in 1989. More of everything, more booms, more skimmers, more barges for storing recovered oil, more tugs for moving all these barges around and taking care of them. And also very important, there's now a fishing vessel program in which about 350 Alaska fishing vessels participate, and they're under contract and trained to be able to go out and participate in the response under quite short notice if there should be another oil spill. So as best we can determine and as best we can accomplish, a lot more would happen if there were another big oil spill, and it would happen a lot faster.
What else do you think is needed to address this shipping safety in Prince William Sound?
Well, one of our big concerns at the moment is this. The requirement for dual tug escorts for loaded oil tankers in Prince William Sound arises from the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which was passed soon after the Exxon Valdez spill. And it requires the tug escorts only for single-hull tankers. Now, single-hull tankers are being phased out, also as required by OPA 90, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. And they will all be gone as a matter of law by 2015. And it appears that in Prince William Sound, all the single-hull tankers may be gone as early as 2012. And since double-hull tankers are a good thing for preventing oil spills, we'll be glad to see the single-hull tankers go. However, we are concerned that when they go, the future of this wonderful system of escort tugs will be in peril because there's no requirement any longer that any tanker be escorted in any way, since federal law is silent on the question of escorts for double hulls. And so our council has started a vigorous effort to try and preserve the double escort system for double hull tankers, even after the federal requirement related single hull tankers goes away.
Stan Jones is with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. He says a resolution calling for the preservation of the two escort tug system is making its way through the Alaska legislature right now. Tomorrow's panel takes place at 10:30 and is open to the public. Congressman Don Young is the only member of Alaska's current congressional delegation who was in office when the Exxon Valdez tanker ran aground 20 years ago. He was flying to California to visit family when a call came over the plane's radio with a message of the accident. Young says it was the Coast Guard commandant telling him what had happened.
I got on the radio with him, and he says, "We got a bad one." And I said, "How bad?" And he says, "Really bad." And I says, "Burn it." And he says, "I can't." And I says, "Just touch a match to it." And he couldn't because of DEC, the state, the federal EPA, air quality standards were in question. No one really recognized, other than the commandant, how bad it was. My solution was the right solution.
Some test burns were done, but federal and state regulators never allowed a major burn-off of the spill. Congressman Young says the disaster's silver lining was crafting the Federal Oil Pollution Act of 1990, or OPA 90. It put in place stricter rules for shippers, as well as prevention and response plans.
The good thing is, I believe, because no one was prepared, not only in Alaska, across this nation, in every port, they had no oil response at all. No ability to handle the tanker. And so consequently, because of the Valdez incident, we were able to put in every port that receives oil from abroad, which most of our oil comes from, we are able to respond to.
Young says he wants to make sure regulations don't loosen in Prince William Sound. He agrees with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council and wants to see a two-tug escort system kept in place.
My argument is that's a very short-priced insurance form, but we ought to have the double tug escort through the straits. I don't think we'll have to do it legislatively, but if we have to, we will. We're going to get a commitment that this will continue. It's not cheap, and the industry knows that. It also costs the state. State also pays for it, too. But I think it's worthwhile to do so.
Young says while Alaska and the U.S. might have tight standards and requirements, vessels flagged under other countries are harder to monitor. The UN body, the International Maritime Organization, has agreed to work toward phasing out single-hull tankers, but Young says that may prove difficult to enforce.
Anything we ship on our coast will be a double-hull tanker, but that which comes in, I don't know who's going to police it. In fact, I've had to inquire the Coast Guard what do they think, and they haven't got back to me yet. And when I do, I'll let you know, because I think we're still going to be faced with that.
Young says no matter what safety measures are in place, it's impossible to guarantee that another oil spill disaster won't ever happen again.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
A University of Alaska Museum curator is part of a team that's discovered a new species of prehistoric marine predator. Museum of the North Earth Sciences curator Patrick Druckenmiller, working with paleontologists from Norway, excavated fossilized remains of the pliosaur on the Arctic island of Spitsbergen last summer. Druckenmiller says 20,000 skull and other bone fragments found are from a species of massive reptile that swam the sea 147 million years ago.
These are animals that had skulls up to, in this case, probably close to 10 feet in length, with massive, heavily built conical teeth, but a short neck, and then a very large teardrop-shaped body, and then two sets of paddles that, effectively their front and hind limbs are modified into big swimming organs or paddles that they use to propel themselves through the water and steer with.
Druckenmiller says the paleontology team has worked with other scientists to flesh out what the pliosaur looked like alive. He equates the creature, which was up to 50 feet long and weighed around 40 tons, to an underwater Tyrannosaurus rex.
I can imagine that if you were living in the seas at those times, this was the animal you would have been on the lookout for more than any other, because it could have made an easy meal of just about anybody with the skull 10 feet long and the size of the teeth that we found, which are literally as big around as cucumbers. It's hard to imagine. There's certainly nothing alive today that really compares in its body proportions and kind of mode of life.
Druckenmiller says finding the fossilized pliosaur is significant because populations of large predators were relatively small and evidence of them is rare. He says the Spitsbergen Island excavation site has only seen minimal survey for fossils and is a great find for paleontologists.
This is now one of the premier sites in the world for Jurassic-aged marine reptiles such as plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs. And It's been really fun to be part of this project, to sort of kind of go back 100 years in time almost and pretend you were one of the first people moving into an area, you know, exploring the new west of the U.S. or something like that. So we've had a really great time of it.
Druckenmiller and the rest of the international team plan to return to the island north of Norway to continue exploration work this summer. A Discovery Channel documentary features an animated rendering of the pliosaur. The show, Predator X, airs March 29th. A new book entitled Wild Moments, Adventures with Animals of the North, offers a collection of stories that documents interactions between humans and wild beasts and birds of the North. Editor and one of the authors, Michael Engelhard, is a Fairbanks resident and wilderness guide. He says, "We became who we are as human beings because of our coevolution with animals." But he says, many people are losing that contact.
There are more people coming up, especially to Kaktovik and places like that, that really want to see polar bears now that they're threatened, and also the big porcupine caribou herd when it's migrating. That's just one of the most spectacular sights a human can ever hope to behold. It's like, I always say, what the buffalo herds must have looked like 150 years ago.
Michael, are you hoping that the book will help educate urbanites about the value of wild beasts? Or is the idea more to document encounters that may become less common in the future?
It's actually both, because I made sure that a lot of these stories take place on the interface between wilderness and urban environments. And up here in Alaska, that is pretty common, that you live in town like Fairbanks or Anchorage and you have the wildlife encounters right there on your doorstep. 50%, I read a figure somewhere that 50% or more of Americans now live in urban environments. So many of those think that wilderness is something that happens out there, but actually it's all around us and there's no clear dividing line. And we here in Alaska residents are more aware of that than probably people in the lower 48. And a lot of these stories are set in, you know, urban settings or in suburban settings where animals do come and visit. The territories overlap.
As you mentioned, at least half the population lives in urban areas, and people have less encounters than perhaps they used to years ago. Many people have to either live vicariously through books such as this collection or television programs. What do you think the future holds for encounters between wild creatures and human beings?
As a guide, I come out of an oral storytelling tradition. We've been telling stories around the campfire to entertain the guests and to educate the guests about the places in which we take them for, you know, me personally, for decades. Like Hank Lanfer is a good example. He has a story in the book called The Voice of Home about the cranes down. He lives in southeast Alaska, in, just on the flyway where the sandhill cranes migrate. And he talks a lot about how some of the hunters that come from the lower 48 and hunt there, how they are not even aware what these birds are. He tells the hunters what they are, what they do, and in that way also educates the reader of the story about the cranes. And a neat spin on it, he decides actually to follow the cranes to their wintering grounds into California. So he hops on the plane and goes down and talks about the habitat loss that affects the crane population in California and the Central Valley and those places that are more and more developed for intensive agriculture.
Anchorage is a city struggling with how to balance a love of wild creatures like bears. We have a growing, it seems, population of bears within the city limits with a need for basic citizen safety. Do you have any suggestions either from a writer or a guide's point of view?
Education is the key there, because a lot of these encounters could be actually could be avoided by people just using a little more safety precautions. Like I seem to remember some of the incidents in Anchorage involved people running and biking around dusk in these city parks, and I think that is just behavior that triggers certain things. That is almost too risky to indulge in. And we have to make a decision at some point what is more important for us, this opportunity to interact with wild animals in close proximity or indulging in whatever we want to do at whatever point in time we want to do it.
Michael Engelhardt is the editor of Wild Moments, Adventures with Animals of the North. The book is now available in stores and through the University of Alaska Press. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.